listening to IsraelScene.com, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram. Several weeks ago, Steve, you remember we put up a broadcast program with Rabbi Ruth Gan Kagan, only active renewal rabbi in Israel, with a kehillah in Jerusalem. We talked a little bit about how she became a renewal rabbi. And today we have a program, an interview with her husband, Michael Kagan, who is the author of the Holistic Haggadah. And this is a perfect program for those wishing to get into the mood for the Pesach Seder coming soon. I'm looking at this Haggadah that was written by Dr. Michael Kagan. And the picture on the cover is not the usual Haggadah picture. It's a traditional yin-yang symbol, but it's made out of matzah. I guess that's the Pesach element in it. And I'm curious why it's called a holistic Haggadah.
Thank you, Yoram. Well, I guess the symbol of the yin-yang sums up what I've been trying to do over the last 15 years in understanding myself as a Jew, and trying to bring this deeper understanding of what Judaism can be to others, whether Jewish or not Jewish. The yin-yang symbol, and I'm not a Buddhist, I'm not a Zen Buddhist, and I'm not a Chinese, but the symbol, and I do talk about it inside the Haggadah, represents shlemut, wholeness, the flow of life contained within the circle of the whole, the black and the white, the good and the bad, the left and the right, the male and the female. Now, all these components, the dualistic aspect of living, understanding that it's part of a whole, of the wholeness, the oneness. And this is really the theme that I was searching for many years ago, almost 20 years ago, after I had felt a very deep sense of, I guess the best Jewish word for it is galut. And we all know galut means exile, the diaspora, the galut. But I felt a deep sense of galut from myself. Oh, I was keeping Shabbat, keeping mitzvot, doing this, doing that, doing what I was told I should be doing and what was expected of me. But inside was this piece that was missing, many pieces that was missing. I began this journey to look for those missing pieces, to look for the questions that I never even heard of before, and not any of my teachers here could even express. Native Americanism and Buddhism and Taoism and all kinds of other mystical things and martial arts. And I began to realize what was I in galut from? I was in galut from myself. And being in galut from myself, I understood I was in galut from God. What was I in galut for? What was this exile? I believe I was in exile from my own body, for one. I believe that I was in exile from my physical body, my emotional body, my spiritual body. Probably the only part of me that I was more or less in touch with, I suppose, was my intellectual body, because that's what I'd been trained in. Universities and this and that was seemed to be working okay. I realized as well that what is true for me, and this is also a Kabbalistic idea, the micro and the macro, that what is true for me is true for the people, what is true for the people is true for the world. And Kabbalah says, and what is true for all of that is true for the Shekhinah as well. But let's leave that one aside. So the Jewish people have been in exile from its land. That means exile from its body, so to speak, and hence we became people of the book. And that's what we could carry around with us. We weren't allowed to own land for so many hundreds of years, not really. We never came back to agriculture in a big way anywhere. But we carried our brains with us, and we became people of the mind, and we were very good at that. We know that Geula, redemption, means coming back to land, and in a lot of our prayers we talk about coming back to Shekhinah, back to spirit, coming back to God, and God will come back into the land and dwell amongst us again. And my realization was, well, that's true for me. And that was a wow for me. That was a wake-up call. Well, you know, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, these are characters that we read about in our book. My realization was, they're not out there. They're in here. They're in me. I have Avraham in me. This book is about my story. Not only our story, their story, but my story. Not my ancestor's story, me, Michael Kagan. And that started an amazing journey into what I called holistic Judaism, which integrates mind, body, and soul, integrates Kabbalistic thinking, Hasidut, halacha. And at the time, term came to me, I thought, wow, this is new. This is great. This is new. It was totally new for me and totally new for the people that I was talking to and teaching and learning from. And then, of course, I began to find out about Reb Zalman Schechter and that he's been doing this for ages, and finding out about Chassidut, and they've been talking about it for ages. But what was different was, this was my say on it, my perspective. And I think what I encourage people to do a lot is to write their own midrash, their own story, their own perspective. The Haggadah that you were referring to, I mentioned it many times. So what's your story? So what is your Egypt? So what is your coming out of Egypt? What is your suffering? What is your fear? So we acknowledge that the themes are not new, but the perspective is new as I'm unique and as new as you are unique. And I think that's incumbent upon each one of us to write their own book and their own commentary on their own book. So that's where the Haggadah, the holistic Haggadah, came out of. I try to bring this sense of holism to it. And the feedback that I've got from all around the world is that, wow, this does it. This answers questions that I've never even thought of before, or that I've thought of but nobody's been able to answer. What is all this got to do with today, to my spiritual welfare, to my family, to my children, my inner child, all these kind of questions.
And how does the Haggadah go about, in the context of Seder and so on, go about presenting those questions? And maybe we could go over them one by one in the context of the Seder plight.
Well, first of all, it's the standard Hebrew text. So I haven't written a new Haggadah, and it's very important. There is a couple of additional prayers or paragraphs that I put in. One is around the cup of Miriam, which is an innovation now over 40 years old. So we have on the table a glass or goblet of water representing Miriam, Mayim, and next to or juxtaposed to the costs of Elijah, which is filled with wine. And there is an additional paragraph that I found in a recent Haggadah that refers to a medieval Haggadah, which counters one of the most difficult paragraphs in the Haggadah, which is Shvoch Hamatcha, pour out your wrath. We say to God, pour out your wrath amongst the nations who do not... Your wrath. Pour out your wrath amongst the nations who do not believe in you and who continuously attack your chosen ones. That kind of theme, which I guess has a place in the Haggadah. We say, Dor v'dor, every generation there has come, arisen up one who has attacked us. And we do feel the pain, and we shouldn't deny that pain. It's difficult, though, within the context of the Haggadah today, sitting in my peaceful home in Jerusalem, not ignoring the violence all around us. Nevertheless, on that particular night, with my children around me, to open the door, to welcome him, Elijah, and the Messiah, and the everlasting peace, to shout out, Shvoch Hamatcha, pour out thy wrath. So it's difficult. So there is a medieval counter to that, which is pour out your love amongst those who believe you. And that's a beautiful, beautiful paragraph that I have introduced into the Haggadah. I didn't make it up, but it's a very good juxtaposition to Shvoch Hamatcha, pour out thy wrath.
The other symbols in the Haggadah, in the Seder, do you see them in a different light than was traditional when you grew up?
Very much so. Let me start with the most obvious one, which is the matzah, the leavened bread, this dried, cardboard-like material that we have to eat, especially on the first night. So I remember, I think in all the starim that I ever attended, the Seder nights in my father's home, my home when I first came to Israel, that it comes to the point where at the beginning of the Seder, of the evening, you hold up the middle of the three matzot and you say, Ha lachma anya, this is the bread of my poverty. But before you do that, you take the middle one and you break it. And then you say, Ha lachmanya, this is the bread of my poverty. And I always felt, I asked the question, why are we breaking it? Why doesn't anyone pay any particular attention to breaking it? It's just you read the instructions in the Haggadah, uncover the matzot, take out the middle one, break it, one a smaller piece, one a bigger piece, and then say, Ha'alachmanya. So I began to meditate on this breaking of the matzah. It's a whole matzah. In fact, it has to be totally whole. And if a little piece is chipped on the corner, you're required actually to replace it. So it's all whole. And sometimes you have to search through the box to find one that's not chipped or broken. So you have a whole matzah. And you hold it up and you break it. And you say, this is my poverty. I recognize that once I was whole, either as a child or as a baby or as a fetus or pre-fetus, there is wholeness I was, but now I'm not. And a certain point in my development, things began to break and crumble in me as my ego self came in and rejected and exiled from the garden, distance from God, distance from self. And so I start the whole night saying, you know, I am broken, but where do I want to get to? I want to get back to the wholeness. And that's done at the end of the Seder, when we eat the bigger piece, which represents the Geula, the redemption, the coming of the Messiah. And we sing, Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim, next year we'll be in the rebuilt Yerushalayim, Jerusalem. So the journey of the evening starts off with this wholeness, straight into brokenness, which we identify as the journey down into Egypt, Mitzrayim, the narrow place, the broken place, out through the story, through the telling, through the eating, through the praising, through the singing, back to the state of wholeness. So after we break the matzah, the story begins. And as many of us know, and as children, the most exciting part of the evening, say the four questions, the Manishtana. I was the eldest in the family, the firstborn, and for many, many years it would me who would stand on the chair in front of my uncles and aunts. Manishtana halayla hazeh. How is this night different from all other nights? So in fact, I chose as the subtitle of my Haggadah, how will you be different this Passover night? Not how is this Passover night different from all other nights, but how will I be different when this night is over? Because at the end of the night, all I have to say is, well, that was pretty good. It was better than last year, wasn't it? You know, and I wonder where we're going to be next year and what's next on the calendar. Then I think I would have missed the point. The transformative process, as it is within the whole year, is to actually go into my own Egypt, feel the pain, feel my slavery within my Egypt, and come out. That the whole night is this night of the door opens. Will you walk through? Will you come out? And the ceremonies and the talking and the questioning and the eating and the praising is to bring me to a higher sense of consciousness so that I will actually be freer and will be less out of Egypt than I was before. And as the year cycles around, I move further out, further out, further out. But inevitably, I'm still in, so I have to get out again. And each time, hopefully, it's a higher madriga, a higher level, and a higher level of acknowledging my Egypt, acknowledging my self-slavery to Egypt, and coming out. And this coming out brings you closer to God. So the Manishtana is a beautiful example of this journey. And what I'd like to do is just to read how I, from the Haggadah, how I redefine this Manishtana sing-along that sort of describes very nicely what we do and what we don't do, and what many Haggadot write about this, these four questions. Why do we have them? To keep the children interested. And later on, there are all kinds of things to keep the children awake. And that's nice, very nice. But I think we can go deeper than that. And that's what I'm attempting to do. So,
would you call this a Seder for adults?
Definitely for adults with inner children. It's very difficult when I sit with my children and try to do this Haggadah. And one of the instructions that I give at the beginning of the book is, if you're with family and children and all that, read it, make notes, close it, and leave it at home. don't bring it to the table, because it'll take you into places and into meditations that other people might not be able to keep up with or feel comfortable with. So let me go into the Manishtana to give you a taste of what I'm trying to do. So the first of the questions or statements, or what we call kushiyot, paradoxes that we deal with in the Manishtana, that on all other nights we eat, or we can eat, both chametz and matzah, unleavened bread and matzah, which is leavened bread, the special bread on Pesach. But on this night, Pesach night, everything is matzah. There is no chametz. There's nothing that is leavened. And this is connected to all the cleaning we do and preparation we do. And preparation we do in our kitchens, in every corner of the house, but in our inner selves as well. Looking for stuff that's fermented, you know? Things that have gone off. Things that I don't need anymore in my life. Things that maybe last year I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I really need this, whether it's in my physical life or my emotional or spiritual life. Or technical life, yes. Upgrade. So, and I look at it this year and I go, oh dear, that's gone off a little bit. You know, can't boot that one up anymore. That has lost its meaning. Not bad. It just needs to be taken out and burnt before Pesach. Clean it out. Clean out the house. So every night we can eat chametz and matzah, leavened and unleavened bread. But on this night, it's only matzah, this unleavened bread. So I say, the order of these questions is significant and can be seen as an abbreviated process of healing into God, like a Jewish four-step program. And for those of you who are familiar with the 12-step program for Alcoholics Anonymous, so this is, I guess, the four-step program for Egyptians Anonymous. Nothing, not that I have anything against Egyptians, but Mitzrim, okay? People who are in dire straits. So step one is to recognize that you are trapped and living the life of a slave. Be willing to deflate your ego. Now, ego is symbolized by chametz, leavening process. It inflates. When I eat a piece of mother's pride, white processed bread, not that I ever eat that stuff, but when I eat bread, if you were to look at it under a microscope, you would see that it's full of holes. In fact, around 70 to 80% just holes. That's part of the leavening process. And therefore, one can make a symbolic relationship between my ego and bread. I'm just full of hot air, you know. Just, you know, what's the substance to me really? And if I could get to the essential me, which is the unleavened bread, the matzah, I can deflate my ego, not destroy my ego, not blow it up, not kick it out, but deflate it. So that I am my true size. I am who I really am. I will get to a point of humility, and I'm reading now again, practicing humility, admit that you cannot do this on your own, and allow yourself to turn back to God. This is the process of coming out of slavery. You cannot do it on your own, and you need to turn back to God. So the second question, or that on all other nights we eat other vegetables, but on this night, maror, bitter ones. And this is part of what continues further along in the ceremony of the Seder night, is that we eat maror, which is a very bitter herb, lettuce, romaine lettuce, or even better, horseradish grated a few hours earlier. Causes your eyes to sting, crying, shooting up into the head, all kinds of strange side effects. Definitely cleans the sinuses. And this is the maror, the bitterness. So to this I add step two. Be willing to face the bitter truth of who you are and how you are living your lives. Practice telling the truth. And this step of practicing telling the truth is very profound. What is it to tell myself the truth on the inside and to align that with telling the truth on the outside? Do I live two stories or one story? My outer story, my inner story. What is it to be aligned so that I'm really true to myself and I'm really true to everybody around me? I think this is actually the definition of a tzaddik, the righteous person, who only has one story, the inner one and the outer one, and they're aligned in truth, not in lies, in truth. The rasha, the evil one, has only one story. The inner one and the outer one are matched, but that's the side of the untruth. So the second step is a difficult one. It's the bitter truth. Who am I really? Stop fooling myself. For good and for bad, I probably, some people deflate themselves. Yes, you know, I'm a nothing. You know, I really am a nothing. I really, you know, everything I do is garbage. But you're a great writer. I love your work. Ah, that was an accident. You know, so what is the truth? Can you really face that truth? Step three, that on all other nights, we don't dip our food even once, but on this night, we dip twice. So here is the custom on the Seder night, that at the beginning of the evening, we take a green vegetable and we dip it into salt water. That's one dipping. And later on, when we're doing the ceremonies around the matzah, we take some matzah and we dip it into charoset. And charoset is a paste that's made of dates and apples, grated apples, and cinnamon, mixed with a little wine. Some people put in raisins and nuts, walnuts, grated walnuts or grated almonds. And you make it into a paste. And there's a whole story about this as well that maybe we get to in a minute. But this is really a healing potion. This is a healing potion. Some Haggadot say, oh, this was the mortar that the bricks were stuck together with. I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe no. But all those ingredients that I just mentioned are all highlighted in the Song of Songs, the Book of Love. So actually what we're doing is we're taking the Book of Love of Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, and we're combining them into a paste. And we dip the matzah and we dip the maror, the bitter herb, into the charoset. Just a dip. It says shake it off. And then you eat the maror tinged now with love. And that touch of love is powerful enough to neutralize the bitterness. Just like if you want homeopathy. Just a touch. You don't spoon it down, you don't gulp it down. Just a touch on the maror is enough to neutralize the pain through the power of love. So step three is, do not be afraid to step into the layers of pain that surround the heart. Grieve all the losses and be willing to let the tears flow. Now the tears is a reference to what I said before, taking green and dipping it into salt water. The salt water are your tears. So do not be afraid to grieve all the losses and be willing to let the tears flow. That's the first dipping. Renew the contact with your heart energy. Let the inner bitterness be miraculously transformed by love into love. And that's the reference I made to the second dipping that comes at the other end of the story. Once we've gone through this process, go through the grieving, go through the bitterness, the pain of being a slave, acknowledge it, and then begin the journey out by dipping into the essence of love. Okay, so what's the fourth question of the Manishtana? That on all other nights, we eat either sitting or reclining, but on this night, we all recline. So this goes back to the Roman times of the symposia, where people would be laid out on couches and servants would come and give them food and everyone would be leaning and eating as free people or sitting, just like, you know, I do regularly. But on the Passover night, there is this emphasis on eating while reclining. So some people sit around the table and symbolically lean to the left while eating. In my house, actually, we don't sit around the table for the whole night. We sit around in the big salon on couches and sofas and cushions, and everyone's leaning the whole night and spread out. And it's this real sense of relaxed time. Relaxed time. So what is the step four in the process that relates to this reclining? Now, I did mention just a moment ago that we reclined on the left side. And this, we have to understand a little bit of Kabbalah, but I don't want to go too deeply into this, because the left side is the side of judgment. So it reads, step four, let your over-judgmental self rest by practicing acts of loving kindness. Let yourself be, feel, let yourself be filled with compassion. Okay, so by leaning on the left side, you're reducing the power of judgment, releasing the right side, which is the side of loving kindness and compassion. So you're letting compassion into your life and you're acting compassionately. For instance, one of the traditions around the Seder night is to pour wine for other people, to bring food for other people, to make sure everybody else is okay. So this is already enacting compassion and loving kindness. Hand over to God the heaviness of your burden and let yourself rest in God's hands. For God has promised to deliver you if you are willing to be delivered. Which is really the theme of Pesach. We can't do this on our own. This is the theme of the 12-step program. We can't do it on our own. We have to admit we're stuck. We have to turn it over to God. And God will come and God will deliver and God will take us out and God will bring us back to the land.
What is the next significant element in the Seder? There's a number of fours. Do we get to another one of the fournesses?
Four seems to be a very significant number throughout the Seder. We have four glasses of wine or grape juice, whichever you prefer, that are spread out from the beginning all the way through to the end. There are the four questions or paradoxes that I just mentioned. And immediately after that, there's another four, which are the four children. So what is this number four referring to? Well, we know that four is very significant all through our tradition, and I think many other traditions. We can look at it as four worlds. It's similar to what I talked about earlier, my spiritual world, my intellectual world, my emotional world, my physical world. And that's the one that I bring most into the Haggadah, this idea again of holism, the holistic Haggadah. And let me move on to the four children, and maybe we'll see that picture even more, because the four children talk about four archetypes. They usually refer to sons. In my Haggadah, they're children or daughters. And these are four archetypes that either exist externally, in other words, I know people who are like this, and I know people who are like that, and I know people who are like that, and that, and that. Or they're actually parts of myself. I have my wise self, I have my alienated or rebellious self, I have my naive self, and I have that part of me doesn't know how to ask, doesn't want to even ask. I have all those. And each one is playing out between them. Now, what I've tried to do in this Haggadah is to add this element of surprise. So usually one says, well, which is the highest of the ladder here? The wise one, the rebellious or alienated one, the naive one, or the one that doesn't know how to ask? So usually in most Haggadot you have pictures, and pictures have been in Haggadot from all the way back. And you see this very learned, scholarly son standing up asking for the wise man. And you see, now it's interesting, different Haggadot, you see maybe a soldier, or you see a ugly-looking person, a thief-looking person, a scruff-looking person, or in some Haggadot, a modern-looking person, who is the rebellious one, the alienated one, or in some translations, the wicked one. And then you have this sweet child who stands up and asks the naive one's question. And then you have the little baby sitting there, just looking with a little smile. And we all look at him and say, never. When he grows up, he'll learn how to ask questions. So what I've done is turned it on its head. I've said, who's the top of the ladder? Well, you know, I'm a know-it-all. At least I think I know it all. At least I thought I knew it all in what I described earlier in my own personal journey. There's a point in one's life where you've been educated, you got your PhDs, you think you know it all. And then you find out you know nothing. A little bit, as my scientific self says, the turn of the 19th century where science thought that it knew it all. It just had just a couple more pieces to fit into place, Newtonian physics, and we'll know everything about the universe. It's all deterministic. And then came along Einstein, and then came along the uncertainty principle, Heisenberg, and until we realize, you know, it's not only we don't know much, we can't know much. It's not possible to know it all. Humility, right? That was a great blow, innovation, progress of the 20th century in quantum physics. So we get to this point where we are know-it-alls. Feels good until the cracks begin to appear. When the cracks appear, you go into a higher self, which is you begin to question everything I'm doing and everything I've done and everything I've been told and question my paradigm. Is this really the truth? Is this really how I'm meant to be living my life? Is this about me or is it about you? And I use this language deliberately because it's a takeoff from the actual text on the Force Children. Is it your life that you want me to lead, or what happened to mine? So part of the growth to the higher level necessitates this shvirata kelim, this breaking of vessels, this rebellion, this alienation, this questioning. So suddenly, instead of rasha, the evil one, the wicked one, it's, wow, he's going through a shift. Poor thing. You know, it could be accompanied by depression, it could be accompanied by leaving home, it could be traveling, or there's many ways it takes, but it's necessary, and all spiritual traditions and paths talk about this, even using phraseology such as madness, dark time of the soul. Got to go through it. And then you come out as the naive one, where you begin to start asking questions anew. Wow, what, you know, I always thought that I knew everything, but now could you tell me what this is all about? What is this about? And then, if you're lucky, you get to the highest level. It's nothing to say. It's the one who doesn't have anything to say. It's not the one who doesn't know how to ask. It's just the being in present time. Being. And this is a very Kabbalistic journey, if you want, all the way up to Atzilut. It doesn't really matter, the higher realms, where you're in this state of oneness, of enlightenment, if you want to talk about it that way, of being. So I look at the four children here as a ladder that takes you up to one stage, to the wise one, then takes you up even higher to the one that doesn't even have something to ask. So, the night progresses, the pages turn, the singing is sung, the children get impatient. When's the food coming? Everybody asks the most important question of the evening. When's the food coming?
When do we eat?
When do we eat? But there's still more to be read, and it's not about the reading. And this is something that I try to really emphasize. It's about experiencing. It's not about reading. It's not about relating. It's about going into the experience of going down into your own Egypt, facing that bitterness, and being guided out. So I want to jump to the 10 plagues. The 10 plagues are also very, how would I call it, a popular moment in the evening where the narration has ended. And once again, the children are back at the table. Oh, the 10 plagues, we're going to spill our wine. And as we know, there is this tradition of enunciating each of the 10 plagues. And as you do so, to dip a finger into the wine and dipping out, or some people spill out, little portions of your wine into the saucer. And so the question arises, what's this about? You know, what's this about? Why am I spilling wine? So the usual answer is given, so that I will reduce my joy a little bit. My joy should be reduced because, you know, after all, a lot of Egyptians died so that I could be free. So in order to recognize that, acknowledge that, I reduce the amount of joy symbolized by the wine. One can also say, if you're more Judo-centric, if you want, well, think of how many Jews died. Hebrews, there were no Jews in those days. How many Israelites, Hebrews, died in slavery? So before we get into the full swing of our celebrations, our big meal and all that, stop for all those who were killed and murdered. And this is, as a Jew, you know, highly significant. My father went through the Holocaust. Before I celebrate my freedom, whoa, what about my grandparents? They didn't make it. And all the family, except for two, didn't make it. So before I start enjoying myself, spill a bit of wine. And remember, I'm lucky. I'm lucky to have got through. But then I ask another question. In my own life, in order to be where I am right now, sitting in a lovely house, thank God, in Yerushalayim, in the area of Baka, trees all around me in the garden, a book that I published in front of me, interviewed by my good friend Yoram. What did it take to get here? What were all the sufferings that I inflicted on others so that I could be here now? The first person I think that I cause suffering to is my mum. She was the one who had to carry me around inside her for 9 months and then birth me. And I do know from having witnessed my wife giving birth 5 times that that is a very, very painful process. So my mother had to go through pain to bring me into the world. This is the... So one can translate the term Makat Bechorot, the plague of the firstborn, perhaps as that. This is the first smiting that comes through the firstborn to the mother. Okay, the first one who's born is always the most difficult one. But for me, being a firstborn, that was a total change in my mother's life. They were married, they were having a great time, and along I come. I cause suffering. And all the way through my life, knowingly or unknowingly, I have caused others to suffer. Maybe not big sufferings. But I had a first wife, and it didn't work out. And there was a lot of suffering. I suffered, and she suffered, until we understood that we need to separate and go our separate ways. But there was a lot of suffering. And my child suffered from that. And then I had relationships, and people suffered in those relationships when they ended as well. And my son suffered. And so it goes on. So I need to acknowledge the fact that I have caused suffering in the world at this moment of joy. So it's not about the amount that I'm dipping out when I enunciate each of the plagues. It's the consciousness that I bring to bear at this moment. Yes, there was this suffering that I caused, and there was this suffering I caused. Not that I would want it differently, really, because I'm happy where I am. Thank God I am here right now, happy, happy. So I need to acknowledge, though, that there is a cost. Always there is a cost to my happiness. There is imperfection in life, and that's the imperfection that we live. I'm not sure I would want it differently, or that I have the choice, if I even had the choice. I mean, people say that that's the reason that we came out of the garden. The garden was wonderful, but it was flat. There was no ups and downs. It was flat. And actually, God wanted it this way, so that we can go up and we can go down and we can face suffering and go up and face joy. And that we choose, and it's all about this choice of going up and going down. And sometimes circumstances take us down. So after the 10 plagues, we go into Hallel. And even though we're all sitting there getting hungrier and hungrier and later, and in my family, we're now, I don't know, past 12 o'clock at night, we Hallel, we praise God. And this is one of the secrets to divine service, is to go through praise. Then we're going to ground ourselves through eating, and then we go into more praise, and then we end up in worship. And this is really the way higher and higher up the spiritual ladder. Praise, grounding, and then finally breaking through to worship. And I want to wrap up the whole evening by mentioning one particular item of the service, of the Seder, that as children many of us remember, which is the hiding of the Afikoman by the father usually, or the mother, or the head of the Seder, and the children looking for it during the time of the eating. And I remember once teaching this, and somebody expressed their displeasure at the idea that children have to find what's hidden, and then they bring it, and then they have to negotiate or bargain or bribe or whatever it is with the father in order to end the service, because you can't end the service without this piece of matzah, which is the Afikoman. And she found this is not a good educational process. And I gave a reply that is in my Haggadah and I find satisfactory, which is the child comes to you and said, here, this is the piece that's missing. What is it worth for you? What are you prepared to give up in your life so that you can have this missing piece that when put together, you'll become whole again? The idea of the Mashiach, that we're all the Mashiach, that you're healing. What is it the inner child says to you? And you face this inner child in the reality of a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old holding out this last piece and saying, so what's it worth? And I think that's a beautiful ending to the description of the Seder night and Pesach, that we may all be blessed to become whole again, which we are anyway. It's just that we've forgotten it. To make peace with our inner child, to make peace with the family inside and outside, sitting around the Seder table with our fathers or mothers, or memories of our fathers and the memories of our mothers and memories of our great, of our grandparents or great grandparents, and then our children and our children's children and our grandchildren. What an amazing event. What a time for us to turn to the children and hear their questions and have them turn to us and hear our questions and begin to share the answers. So I wish everyone a blessed Pesach this year.
Thank you very much, Michael. Would you mention the publisher of the Haggadah, please?
The Haggadah is the Holistic Haggadah by Urim Publishers. That's a publication company in Israel. And it's available on their website, Urim Publications, or on Amazon, or from any better Jewish bookshop.
You know, Michael, years ago, Rabbi Zalman talked about a Chanukah, a Christmas Seder, in order, as a way for the Christian community to pass on wisdom from generation to generation. On our next interview with you, Michael, I think we'd like to talk about the connection between Christianity and Judaism. In the meantime, thank you very much. Chag Sameach and Chag Kasher.